Hi, and welcome to this audio edition of Polygamy, What Love Is This? With host Doris Hansen. On this program, we discuss polygamy and Mormon fundamentalism from a biblical Christian perspective. We talk about the history of polygamy, its modern-day fruit, share stories from people who have escaped polygamy, and talk about current events relating to polygamy. You can learn more about the video edition of this program at whatloveisthis.tv. And now, here's Doris.
Good evening. Once again, we welcome to our program, Polygamy, What Love Is This? My name is Doris Hansen, and I'm the host of the program. Our goal of this show is to bring out polygamy, to talk about it, not to hide it, and not to redefine it, but to talk about it and bring it out in the open, to talk to the polygamous people and let them know that God is not asking you to live polygamy to get you a ticket into heaven. There is another way, and we want to talk about polygamy and the truths, the biblical truths of polygamy. We know that polygamists are people too. We're not here to bash the polygamy people. We love them, and we just want them to know the truth. I was born and raised in a polygamy group and into a polygamous family. My dad, my father, had only two wives and 16 children. And I say only because for a polygamy group, that's a pretty small family. But it was not a good life. It was not an enjoyable life at all. And before they could marry me off, when I was 18 years old, I ran away before they could marry me off to a man over twice my age with already over a dozen wives and I don't know how many children. It wasn't until many, many years later that I had the courage to do my own studying. And I went into the Bible and combed it with a fine-tooth comb over and over again. I wanted to find out where God commanded polygamy, and it isn't there. There is nothing in the Bible that says that polygamy is God's way to heaven. It has no part of His salvation plan. And that was quite a delightful relief, I want you to know. And I encourage you to do your own studying. Just because you're told something doesn't make it true. You need to do your own studying, and that's what we ask you to do. This is a live broadcast from Salt Lake City. It's a telephone call-in program, and we will be opening up the telephone lines a little bit later in the program for you to call in and give your comments and your questions. We'll have a question and answer time, and we will be inviting you to call in. The telephone number is 801-973-TV20. That's 801-973-8820. I would like to remind our polygamous viewers of the webpage, shieldandrefuge.org, where you can go on there and find information about biblical polygamy. There's articles that are about polygamy and what God has to say about it. And there's also a contact page that you can go on and contact someone if you have questions, or if you are interested in leaving a polygamy group, you can contact someone and you can find a safe exit. There are people who have left polygamy and put their stories on that webpage, and they've never regretted leaving, and they've had a life abundant afterwards. So we do invite you to go to the webpage. We also would like to mention that we do know that in polygamy groups, you can live in fear of almost everything. We do know that there are viewers out there who may have an interest in calling into our program, but they're afraid to simply because their voice might be recognized, or their name might be recognized, or someone might find out you're watching the program when you shouldn't be and get in trouble. But you might still have a question or a comment for the program, and you'd like to call in, but you're afraid to. You know, you don't need to be on the air when you call in. If you have a question or comment and you're afraid that you're going to be found out, just call in, and when the operator answers the phone, mention the fact that you're anonymous and you don't want to give any personal information, but you do have a comment or a question, and they will give that to me and I can read it on the air. No one will know that you did it or that you were involved with the program at all. So I invite you to give that a try as well. Our webpage for the program is aboutpolygamy.com. You can go on there and find future programming listed and also previous shows on streaming video. If you know someone outside of the viewing area, they can watch the program from there. We don't have live streaming video yet, but hopefully we'll be having that sometime in the future. And then finally, our email address is tv@aboutpolygamy.com, and we do invite you to email us any questions that you don't want to ask on the air, or perhaps you didn't get on the air, email us your questions, your concerns, or suggestions. If you liked our panel discussion last week, perhaps you would like to have a particular topic addressed in a future panel discussion, call us and let us know. And speaking about our panel discussion of last week, we do hope you enjoyed it. We got quite a bit of response from people that did not get on the air. And I want to bring up a couple of points about this. Some of the people who called in took sharp exception to what Jerry had explained as the Mormon doctrine that she was raised with. If you recall, we had three guests. One was had talked about polygamous doctrine, the other one talked about Mormon doctrine, and the other one talked about Christian doctrine. And a lot of people didn't like what Jerry said, who talked about what she was taught in the Mormon church. So I'd like to bring up a few points regarding what she talked about. First of all, Jerry explained how she had been taught. Neither we nor Jerry claimed that she was an official spokesman for the Mormon church. She was taught what she said she was taught, and so we cannot take issue with that. Secondly, nearly everything that she talked about, she had first gone onto the official LDS website, and she had downloaded much information. In fact, some of it she read word for word off of that website on the air, and so we can't really take exception to that. Next, I and other people verified that what she told actually had been taught in the Mormon church at some time. Now, most of us realize that the Mormon church will change their teaching sometimes from year to year. So maybe something that Jerry was taught 10 or 15 years ago may not be actively taught now, but that doesn't mean it wasn't taught then. And so we can't really take exception with that either. And then finally, the LDS Church puts out a book called Gospel Principles. And everything that Jerry said last week was in and is in the book Gospel Principles, so we can't really take exception to that. However, if you still disagree and you still think that she said something that is not official Mormon doctrine, please email us at tv@aboutpolygamy.com. 2 weeks from tonight, we're going to have a special show, and we're going to deal with many of the questions and comments that came through as a result of last week's discussion. We're going to be talking about other things as well, but we're going to zero in and approach those questions and comments. So please detail what you disagree with that we talked about last week in an email, tv@aboutpolygamy.com, and we will be happy to address those issues next week. Finally, we are in the process of organizing a Life After Polygamy discussion group. And I would like to invite anyone out in our viewing audience who has left a polygamy group or are thinking of leaving one to think about perhaps becoming involved in this discussion group. It'll be kind of like a support group. If you have questions or lingering doubts or just some problems that you want to deal with, there'll be other people there who've gone through what you're going through, and we would just like you to call in and let us know if you're interested. Maybe you'd like to even be interested in helping organize it. Maybe you could give us a suggestion of different things that we should do, or when would you like to have it, once a week or once a month or every 2 weeks, or the timing too. So please feel free to call in at 801-973-8820 if you can't email us. And if you can email us, please give us what your choices would be on by email. And so now we will get down to the business of our show, which is polygamy. And I'd like to introduce our special guest for tonight. He is the founder and the director of Mormon Research Ministry, which was founded in 1979. The Mormon Research Ministry has a twofold mission. First, it's to educate the Christians regarding the difference between Mormonism and Christianity. And the second is to proclaim the gospel of grace to the LDS people. And that is done through website mrm.org and by printed material. He is the author of Answering Mormons Questions by Bethany House Publishers. He is the co-author of Mormonism 101 by Baker Publishers. He is the primary contributor to 10 Questions and Answers on Mormonism by Rose Publishing. He is currently working on a new book that is a topical guide to LDS quotations. He is a contributing writer for the Christian Research Journal, and I am now out of breath with all of what he's done. Welcome, Bill McKeever, to our program tonight. Thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure to be here. Good to be here.
We have some competition on the other channel tonight, so let's see if we can raise a little dust like they are. We know with all of your accomplishments here, we know that you're going to bring in some new information and maybe some things we haven't previously considered as we talk about early Mormon polygamy.
I hope so. It's a fascinating topic.
It is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It definitely is. I remember when I got out of polygamy and the first time I attended a Christian church after I became a Christian, people were asking me, curious about polygamy and all of that. And they said, what group are you from? And I told them, and they looked at me and they said, oh, well, that isn't that this? And they started naming a bunch of information about that group, stuff that I never even knew when I was a member. And I thought, geez, they told us not to tell, and that these people out know more about it than the people living in the groups know about it.
I find that happens a lot with former members. They tend to really want to do a lot of studying and what they were a part of it for a time.
Uh-huh.
And they tend to start getting a lot more deeper into the things that they probably would have as they were members. I find that a lot from ex-Mormons especially, that they're just amazed at how much they didn't know. Because let's be serious, in Mormonism especially, you find that it's a very subjective religion. They feel it's true, therefore mm-hmm. they really don't have a real burning desire to have to study all that much because they already know it's true. So mm-hmm. what's the point of having to study to bolster your faith? I already know it's true by a feeling.
Right.
And so a lot of them really don't.
Right.
And that's sometimes a dilemma when we're talking to the Mormon people, because we're bringing up issues that they've never heard before, and it's very easy for them to say, well, you just made that up, or why are you lying like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a terrible thing to say.
Mm-hmm. You
know?
Yeah.
So it's a common thing. It comes with the territory.
And I've talked with people still in polygamy groups about what I discovered, and one particular person very close to me, she said, well, I know it's true. And I said, well, how do you know that it's true? Well, I just feel it is.
Right.
I just know it is. And I said, but you don't check, you've got to check it out. And of course, that hasn't happened even yet.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, I have a question that I would like to ask you, Bill. We have a caller who calls in and has called in a few times, and he has emailed me privately as well. And he keeps saying that, continues to claim that Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants mm-hmm. is not about polygamy, but is about celestial marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And in my answer, I told him there wasn't really that much difference to my knowledge.
No.
And he said there was. Mm. And so the next week I talked about it a little deeper and brought out in context some of the definite polygamy and the celestial marriage. And he even last week emailed me again and told me it had nothing to do with polygamy but with celestial marriage. So my question to you is, I've tried to explain it to him, and I haven't been able to be very clear, evidently. Perhaps you could help us out with that.
Well, Section 132 definitely starts off talking about, you know, plurality of wives, David and Solomon and so forth and so on. So it's very clear the whole thing starts off as a polygamous message. If you're going to say that it has nothing to do with anything other than the idea of being with your spouse throughout eternity, then I think you run into some real difficulties as to why then did Joseph Smith have to include in verse 52, I believe, where he talks about Emma having to get in line and accept all those that have been given. What does that mean, have been given? Well, from the context, the way it was written, we have to assume it was the women that were already given to Joseph Smith. And, and Emma, we know, had a real problem with polygamy throughout her entire life. When her son was old enough to where they began the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Of course, polygamy was not a part of their teachings. In fact, for many years, many Mormon RLDS, Community of Christ, as they're known now, denied that Joseph Smith even taught this.
Right, they sure do.
There was that much of a denial. It would be difficult to say that it's not about polygamy when you have statements from early Mormon leaders, including Brigham Young, that puts the two terms together in mm-hmm. a sentence. Let me give you some examples here, because usually the best way is to go right to the source. And what did Mormon leaders actually teach about this? And Brigham Young made this comment, and this was on August 31st, 1873. I don't know if this was a verse that you brought up last time, but he said, "You will recollect, brethren and sisters, that it was in July 1843 that he," speaking of Joseph Smith, "received this revelation concerning celestial marriage. This doctrine was explained, and many received it as far as they could understand it. Some apostatized on account of it, but others did not, and received it in their faith." Now, let's think about that. He says, Joseph Smith, okay, gives this revelation, or writes it down, whatever version you want to go with, July of 1843. And he says it was about celestial marriage. But he goes on to say that some actually left the church because of it.
Okay.
They left the church because of celestial marriage. Now, if we're going to take this modern approach and forget the way it was understood in the beginning, because really what you have is this caller, he's using a post-1890, a post-manifesto definition of this.
Absolutely.
They're looking at it completely different. They did go through a change in their definition. But in fact, if people were actually leaving the church over this, you have to ask yourself, why?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mormons tell me one of the greatest things about their faith is the fact that they can be with their families throughout eternity, be with their wife throughout eternity. If that's such a great thing, why are so many people leaving, as according to Brigham Young, over this issue of celestial marriage? Well, because it was tied into polygamy. It was polygamy that people were struggling with. Even Brigham Young talks about how
that's
he struggled.
Right.
Now, he
that's
certainly
right.
got over it rather quickly, you know, but nonetheless, he even talks about how he struggled with it. And so we have to understand that others struggled with it as well. But there's another angle that I think is often overlooked by many Latter-day Saints who hold to this argument that celestial marriage is not the same at all as plural marriage, and that is there was an amnesty petition given by the First Presidency to the United States government after the manifesto. And I actually have a statement here that was taken from The Messages of the First Presidency, which is an LDS book. It's volume 3, page 230, if a person wants to look it up. But it was actually an amnesty petition that was filed to the president, and it was of the United States.
Of the United States, okay.
By the First Presidency and the Council of the Twelve, I believe, at the time. The president at this time was Wilford Woodruff. You had George Q. Cannon and Joseph F. Smith were his two counselors. And so they're asking the government to actually be lenient towards those who were arrested or found themselves in trouble for practicing polygamy. And this is what it says, and this is very telling. It says this. It says, "We formally taught our people that polygamy or celestial marriage,"
okay.
Notice how the terms are used together.
Interchangeably.
"We formally taught our people that polygamy or celestial marriage, as commanded by God through Joseph Smith, was right, that it was a necessity to man's highest exaltation in the life to come. The doctrine was publicly promulgated by our president, the late Brigham Young, 40 years ago, and was steadily taught and impressed upon the Latter-day Saints up to a short time before September 1890. Our people are devout and sincere, and they accepted the doctrine, and many embraced and practiced polygamy."
Okay,
so
that's good.
What we have here is the term being used interchangeably. So it would be, again, very difficult to separate the two concepts.
Uh-huh.
Now, we do know that later on, after the manifesto, there definitely was a change in definitions. For instance, this quote here, this is Messages to the First Presidency, Volume 5, page 329. This is Heber J. Grant and his counselor stated that celestial marriage, that is, marriage for time and eternity, and polygamous or plural marriages are not synonymous terms. Well, you have to understand the reason for this kind of a comment. This is post-manifesto.
Uh-huh.
They better not be the same term, because the Mormons are claiming that they do believe in celestial marriage. And of course, if the government catch wind of them practicing polygamy again, this is going to get them in a lot of trouble. Now, we know that polygamy went on after 1890.
Right.
We know that finally they had to come out with what was known as the Second Manifesto in 1904. This is kind of like the manifesto that is now we mean business manifesto.
Now we really mean
Before
it.
We were just kind of kidding, but now we really mean business, I guess. So there, of course, the language is going to have to change.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're not the only ones that draw this conclusion. There are Mormon historians that admit that there was a definition change post-manifesto era of 1890. For instance, in the Mysteries of God, in the Mysteries of Godliness, written by David John Berger, it's an excellent book on the evolution of the temple ceremony. But he also has an interesting comment in there. He says celestial marriage was applied to and equated with plural marriage.
Okay.
He flat out says this. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. Another well-respected Mormon historian, Thomas G. Alexander, in his book Mormonism in Transition, page 60, does the same thing. He says, generally, the terms new and everlasting covenant of marriage, celestial marriage, and plural marriage were taught or thought to be equivalent.
Yeah, That's the way we were taught. That's exactly the way we were taught.
That's exactly how it was understood. Yeah. So, again, I think a Mormon who wants to say that that's not true has to explain, at least in my mind, why then would Joseph Smith have to say some pretty harsh things to his own wife regarding this teaching. He says, and let mine handmaid Emma Smith receive all those that have been given unto my servant Joseph, and who are virtuous and pure before me, and those who are not pure, and have said they were pure, shall be destroyed, saith the Lord. In verse 54 it says, and I command mine handmaid Emma Smith to abide and cleave unto my servant Joseph, and to none else. But if she will not abide this commandment. Now again, what is this commandment?
Right.
Obviously, context is very important. What, if she does not abide this commandment, what's going to happen to her? She shall be destroyed. That's pretty serious.
Yes, it is.
Now, I have to ask, if it has nothing to do with plural marriage and it has only to do with being with your spouse throughout eternity, then I think it's on the part of the Mormons to explain why Emma doesn't want to be with Joseph Smith throughout eternity.
That's a good question. Also, in the context of 132, he talks about getting 10 virgins.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be in the here and now. He certainly isn't talking about getting the virgins up in yonder heaven.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, didn't Orson Pratt also teach that you had to have permission of the other wives in order to take on a plural wife? I mean, Emma, as far as we know, didn't really go along with this as long as she understood plural marriage to have anything to do with the here and now.
Yeah.
Because we do see that Emma certainly was fooled by her husband for mm-hmm. a time to mm-hmm. think that this is only celestial. Mm-hmm. It's something that's going to happen later on. Well, she finds out, unfortunately, there's an account of Joseph rolling around in the hay with Fanny Alger, and Emma realizes, gee, this isn't just a spiritual type of thing.
It's a real thing.
It has some real physical aspects to it.
All right.
And, of course, she doesn't go along with it. And as far as I know, she never went along with it. So,
yeah, I don't think she did either.
If permission of another spouse was important, then Joseph Smith broke his own rules.
He did.
Yeah, so.
He did. And also, Joseph Smith claimed that an angel from heaven came and held a sword above him and threatened to kill him if he didn't start living this principle. And again, how would that fit in with if it was a celestial marriage rather than something that had to be
right.
done here?
Yeah, right. I mean, what's the big deal?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's going to be something involved here that goes against the social norms. And I can't remember which apostle it was right now, but it may have been Ballard or Nelson who was talking about the fact that one way you can know a false prophet is they bring about sexual ideas that go against the social norms. Well, Joseph Smith did that. I mean, how come they don't see this? You know?
Oh, my goodness.
We have a whole article
how
on our website
is
just
that?
Dealing with that.
Yeah. I'll have to read that one.
So.
Okay. Well, I hope that answers your question, sir, if you're watching tonight. And again, if you still have questions, feel free to email. Also, I would like to remind you that our telephone number is 801-973-8820. You are welcome to start calling in now. If you want to hang on for just a few minutes before we answer the phone, you're certainly welcome to try and get first place on the phone lines. Bill, the second question is going to be quite involved, I think, in our conversation as well. It's going to deal with Jacob Chapter 2 of the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a lot of people who study the subject of polygamy, Mormon apologists, polygamists, and they want to say that there's always the exception. And there is an exception here in Chapter 2, verse 30 of Jacob out of the Book of Mormon. But for our viewers that maybe are not familiar with this chapter, let me establish context. I'm going to just quickly go over some phrases from verses 22 through 35, just so you'll get the context. He is talking in these verses about the grosser crimes of polygamy. In verse 23, the committing of the whoredoms, it's called. In verse 24, it's called wives and concubines. That is abominable, says the Lord. And then in verse 27, he says that there shall not any man among you have save but one wife, and concubines he shall have none. In verse 28, he calls them whoredoms and abominations. In verse 30, then he says, this is the key verse we're going to be talking about tonight. For he, if I will, saith the Lord, raise up a seed unto me, I will command my people. Otherwise they shall hearken unto these things. It's a vague verse, but they use it as being okay to practice polygamy if God needs to have kids. And then verses 31 through 35, it talks about the mourning of the daughters of the people is coming up to God because of polygamy, the cries of the fair daughters. They shall not commit the whoredoms of old, it says in verse 33 and in verse 35, that the hearts of the women are broken and the sobbings of their hearts are going up to God because of polygamy. Okay, now that's the context of what we're going to be talking about. So my question to you, Bill, is this. If we are to believe that the Nephites mentioned in the Book of Mormon were real people, is there any evidence to suggest that they did practice polygamy with God's blessings? And what impact does verse 30 have on all of this?
That's a great question, because and the way you phrased it is good, because with God's blessing is what's important, because certainly we do hear of examples of this. One that you didn't read was taken out of the Book of Ether, chapter 10, verse 5, and it came to pass that Riplakish did not do that which was right in the sight of the Lord, for he did have many wives and concubines, and did lay that upon men's shoulders, which was grievous to be borne. There was a response, a rebuttal to a Christian book written by John Ankerberg and John Weldon that dealt with this issue. And one Mormon apologist from the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, which is now known as the Neil Maxwell Institute, wrote a response to it. And in the response, in the Farms Review of Books, this is what this person said. He said, following the most venerable tradition of anti-Mormonism, Ankerberg and Weldon cite Jacob 2:24 through 29 and Ether 10:5 to argue that the Book of Mormon condemns polygamy, and hence that 19th century plural marriage is denounced by the Latter-day Saints' own scripture. Like their predecessors, though, they carefully omit any mention of Jacob 2:30, which destroys their argument.
Yeah,
now,
okay.
I don't hide from Jacob 2:30. I embrace it. Bring it on. I mean, when you look at Jacob 2:30, we run into all sorts of problems, because when you read it, it talks about if God chooses to raise up seed. Now, in order for polygamy to be necessary, in order to raise up seed, there has to be something involved here, and that is a surplus of females. If you have too many men, polygamy doesn't help you at all.
That's right.
So you have to have a surplus of females. The problem is we don't find this in Mormon history. I wish Mormons would read their books more, because in their own books they find the answers to these questions. And I've been to the Beehive House many times. I've had plenty of fun conversations with the tour guides there.
I bet you have.
And I don't try to get out of line. I just like to throw out a question every once in a while just to get the missionary to think. And one of the things that I often hear when I go through the tour at the Beehive House downtown, they always want to talk about polygamy right off the bat. It's like, okay, we know this subject is going to come up. Let's talk about it. Let's get it out of the way. And then let's go on with the tour. And let's talk about the horsehair couch. And let's talk about the little fairy room where the kids look down on the guests coming in the front door and things like that. But they always want to get polygamy out of the way. And they usually always will say in their lines, they'll say that the reason why polygamy had to be practiced was to take care of the widows from the persecution from either Missouri or Illinois period. Mm-hmm. Nobody can give me a number of how many men were actually killed during this persecution period. One is too many, I will agree. One is too many. But how much loss of life do you really have to have before you have to inject a very offensive teaching, such as the teaching of polygamy, in order to undo it? And if God did do that, how many years would it take before you would see a benefit from that practice? Now, let's be serious here.
Okay.
If God is going to do it to raise up seed, children, and I know having three of them myself, for the first several years are really quite a burden, not only to the family, but to society. They don't produce work. They don't, you know, add anything to the community socially or anything like that, other than they're great to have around and they're fun and things like that. But they really don't add to the society. They are a burden on society till they get around, what, 15, 16, 17, depending.
Well, let's get past the teens.
Well, I'm going back to the 1800s, where they probably put them out in the fields rather young, something we don't do nowadays. But nonetheless, they really weren't an asset, and I'm using that word in quotes because I don't want to sound like kids are not worth anything, because they certainly are. But I mean, for the benefit of the society, they don't really produce anything to help society till they get older.
I see what you're saying.
So we're looking at maybe 18 years of children being the burden on this Mormon community before they really become an asset to the community. They can't vote till they're 21 in the 19th century. So raising up seed for a voting block is out of the question. I mean, you've got 21 years now. So what actually happened during this 21-year period that finally they needed more people? I mean, I would think that if God would command to raise up seed, he's got a plan down the road about 18 to 20 years away where these people are going to be needed. Okay. We don't see that in Mormon history. So here's the thing. If they don't have a surplus of women, then polygamy is really not the answer to the problem. And they never had a surplus of women during the polygamy era.
They never did.
I mean, if you read in Evidences and Reconciliations, John Widtsoe, and I think Mormons need to take notice of this. It says the United States Census records from 1850 to 1940 and all available church records uniformly show a preponderance of males in Utah and in the church. Indeed, the excess in Utah has usually been larger than the whole United States, as would be expected in a pioneer state. I mean, and that would make sense. I mean, this is a religion that is out in the wilderness, if you will, you know, hundreds of miles
from
civilization. And usually you're going to have more men that are going to be capable of living that kind of life away from society like that. So it's understandable that you'd have a lot of men at that particular time. It says, the births within the church obey the usual population law, a slight excess of males. Orson Pratt, writing in 1853 from direct knowledge of Utah conditions, when the excess of females was supposedly the highest, declares against the opinion that females outnumbered the males in Utah. The theory that plural marriage was a consequence of a surplus of female church members fails from lack of evidence.
Right.
So this idea that somehow we're going to need Jacob 230 to raise up seed is nonsensical. And besides, one of the best arguments against Jacob 230 is Joseph Smith. I mean, why in the world is Joseph Smith, we know, had at least, that can be documented, about 34 wives.
That's
Emma and 33 plural wives.
Right.
It's not that difficult to document that many. Some say more. I think D. Michael Quinn puts it up in the 40s, but we can at least document those. We also know from the teaching brought forth by Richard L. Bushman in his book, Rough Stone Rolling, and Todd Compton's book in Sacred Loneliness, that Joseph Smith, among that number, had at least 10 wives that were simultaneously married to living men.
Right.
Polyandry.
Right.
We never see polyandry condoned or even tolerated in the Bible or the Book of Mormon.
Right.
There's just no place you're going to find that. But yet we find Joseph Smith practicing polyandry. He's one guy who's got a wife that has several, well, two husbands at least. We don't know, at least I've never found anywhere, that any of these wives who had living husbands had husbands that were either impotent or sterile. If they had children, then why do they need Joseph
Smith?
Why
do they need the rising up the seed?
Exactly. That needs already being met.
Right.
So why does Joseph Smith have to get involved in this?
Good question.
It's not supported by the Book of Mormon. It's not supported by the Bible. So Joseph Smith really becomes the best argument against Jacob 230. That's just the way it is. I know he was the prophet and kind of could make his own rules, but that's, you know, if we're going to listen to modern Mormons today, it's supposed to be the written word that carries the day, and Joseph Smith seems to be conflicting with it.
It does. And I have two observations that I really have a difficulty with on Jacob 2:30. The first one is that if God wanted to rise up seed for himself, he can have as people can have as many, or let me put it this way, as many children can be born with seven men who each have a wife as one man with seven wives. Mm-hmm. So they're really, you don't need to live polygamy in order to have all these children. And like you say, there's equal births, pretty close to the equal births, and so there's not a problem with getting that.
Think about it this way. When I was at the Beehive House, I got into a conversation with, usually when you walk in and you go to the left, that's Brigham Young's office area, and there's usually an older couple that is there, a missionary couple. And I was talking with a young, not really young, she's probably about my age, and we were talking about this just before the tour began, and I says, well, you were aware that there was never really a lot of females around, you know, during this time period. And I'm just kind of concerned with marriage being essential in Mormon theology for a individual's exaltation. Doesn't it seem a little selfish on the part of guys like Brigham Young, who had, 50-some wives, and John Taylor and Heber C. Kimball? I mean, it seems like they're kind of taken from the pool, more than their share, which makes it more difficult for other Mormon males who need to marry in order to be exalted.
Right.
There's less for them to choose from. And I says, especially, when you had, polygamy, it seems kind of odd because Brigham Young taught, and I didn't mention this to her, I didn't quote it to her, but Brigham Young said that if you're hoping to become a god or a son of God, you must enter into polygamy.
Right.
This is
absolutely
what he taught in 1866.
That was an essential.
Now, I didn't quote that to her, but she did not agree that polygamy was essential for that kind of exaltation. Hmm. And I don't like to get into it too heavy with some of these people. I don't want to get kicked out before I even get allowed in, but so I'm usually very, careful on what I'm going to say. But she was not aware of that. But it doesn't seem to make sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And the next point I would like to make, too, that doesn't make sense to me is we read the context of Jacob 2, verses 22 through 35, and right in the middle of that is verse 30 that we're talking about, and the one that you read in Ether, and there's others in the Book of Mormon, too, that condemns polygamy. When does God call something wicked and abominable? I mean, he uses some pretty harsh words for polygamy in these verses. And then when can something abominable and wicked become good? Is robbing a bank good at any point?
I've had Mormons explain it this way. They will say that in the case of David, for instance, and Solomon, because you have a contradiction between 1:32 and Jacob 2, is that God gave some wives to David and Solomon, but then David took, at least in one case, Uriah's wife. He didn't get permission for that.
Right.
So that was an abomination. So that's how they kind of excuse that.
Really?
Kind of say, well, it's only when God gives you those wives that it's okay. But if you go out and you take one that you shouldn't have had, then you run into trouble. So that's kind of how they skate around.
That's nice to know. That's how they're doing it. But still, he's calling it an abomination. Mm-hmm. Many wives and concubines, grosser crimes.
You're right. It doesn't seem to be qualified quite that way.
Okay, we do have a couple of calls waiting here. We have Douglas in Murray is calling. Hello, Douglas.
Hello. How
Hi.
Are you tonight?
Welcome to the program. We're doing just fine.
Yeah, I was calling in regard to your guest tonight mentioned that many of the authorities in the church, Brigham Young, John Taylor, Joseph Smith, I had always, as a Mormon growing up, until I was 53 years old, that there were not a, it wasn't an open thing that many of the general authorities were the ones who were asked to participate in polygamy. So now also I've heard that, like you mentioned, there were those who married women who were already married to someone else, and the terrible idea
of sending general authorities or other leaders of the church to England or Canada on missions so that, in essence, you could take their wives away from them. Did that sort of thing happen? And also, when we go on to the law of progression, where Jesus and Lucifer are our brothers, and all of us are spirit children, are the actual children of God the Father of this earth, to be someone who reaches the highest degree of the celestial kingdom and moves through eternity to become a god someday is surely going to practice major polygamy, to have thousands or hundreds of wives and all of the children that it would take to populate a world like this one. So we're looking at, like you mentioned, it wasn't something that was blanket. Many of the leaders of the church practiced polygamy. My mother was an all red, and going back in the history of her family, there were polygamists. But it was generally the leaders of the church and many of the others that practiced polygamy were sort of exclusive or invited to this. Is that kind of the way you look at it?
Well, polygamy wasn't even public until August of 1852 at a special session of conference. Brigham Young gave Orson Pratt kind of like the honor of announcing it publicly. But up until that time, especially when they were before the exodus to the Salt Lake Valley, polygamy was practiced secretly. It was only when it started to leak out that it caused Joseph Smith a lot of problems. And a lot of the very people that accused Joseph Smith were those that were, you know, very close to him at one time and found his secret practice of polygamy to be very offensive. I mean, let's think about it. I mean, you have Joseph Smith not only lying to his church about the practice of polygamy, he's lying to his own wife about it.
Oh, terribly.
I mean,
her parents never did like Joseph Smith. Yeah. You know, when they brought about the Aaronic priesthood in the area of the Susquehanna River, and her family lived in that area, Joseph Smith, I don't think, was ever very popular with Emma's parents. Is that the way you look at
That's the way I understand
That's the way
it, right?
I've heard it too, yes.
Yeah, Isaac Hale did not like Joseph Smith. Primarily, one of the reasons was for his folk magic, his involvement in folk magic and glass looking and things like that. That was very troubling to him. That's one thing they do mention that in the Joseph Smith Prophet of the Restoration film Downtown, that Emma's parents did not condone her relationship with Joseph, but they don't tell you why. There's a lot of things in that film they don't tell you. There's more the sin of omission.
He was a con man and a crook and a circle drawer and did all kinds of, searched for buried treasure and also for water. And, you know, they weren't always that successful with that. And so he took a time in history when there was what they called the burnt over district. Religion was a very, very strong and important part of the life back then. And so he grabbed onto something that was an incredible power base for Joseph Smith. When he was in Nauvoo and was the mayor, the president of the church, the head of the militia, I think you could say that Joseph Smith had reached a point where he had all the power he ever wanted.
He reached his pinnacle, that's true.
Right then and there.
And you know, I've also read different ideas on the percentage of people in Salt Lake that lived polygamy in those early days. And I've heard as high as 25% of the people were living polygamy, maybe even higher than that. So it was more than just the leadership.
More than just the leadership, but
right.
Still not a blanket thing. So about 20 to 25%, something like that. That's interesting.
That's because they had all the 25% had all the women.
My family, on both my wife and my side, go back to the early pioneers coming across the plains. And so as a born-again Christian, and with hundreds and hundreds of my family and posterity that were, in essence, shackled to Mormonism, believed in it very strongly, my two sons and I that are born-again Christians are perhaps the only three that ever left the church, you know, without just becoming kind of a what we termed Jack Mormon or somebody that just was inactive. We were the only three that ever truly came to an understanding and became born again believing Christians in the grace of Jesus Christ and his atoning sacrifice on the cross.
Well, good. That's
so,
very enlightening.
I look back and
it?
I think of all the wonderful relatives and family, including my own grandparents and others that were that I knew, that I will never see because they were totally shackled or, you know, believing in this church, the Mormon church, and all of these false doctrines.
Well, we thank you for your call. We have another call waiting, so we better take it, and we do thank you for your input.
Awesome. Thanks for the time, and you guys have a wonderful evening.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Line two, Louise in Clearfield? Or line
yes.
One? How are you tonight, Louise?
I'm fine.
You're on the air.
I just have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
Okay. I'm curious about your, I assume this is a religion, Mormon Research Ministry.
It's a parachurch ministry. We work with Christian churches, but we are not of any one denomination, no.
Okay. So what do you mean you work with other churches?
Well, for instance, if a church is wanting to know more about Mormonism, they'll call me in and I'll do classes on it and teach the people on what Mormon doctrine is all about, how it compares with biblical Christianity, some of the better ways of dialoguing with Latter-day Saints and so forth. Just educating Christians on what the teachings of Mormonism are all about.
So, I have another question for you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me this. Why do you spend your life researching into something that you don't believe, you seem to know a lot about,
mm-hmm.
and isn't it a waste of your time and your life to tear someone else's religion down?
Oh, not at all, Louise. The reason I do it is very simple. You're worth it. And I mean that sincerely. My interest in Mormonism actually stems from many acquaintances that I had growing up in California. I grew up with a lot of LDS people. They were very good friends of mine. I cannot recall any bad memories of growing up with them. But as I became a Christian and they started to want to convert me, and none of them really tried to convert me at all till I became a Christian in 1973. And after that point, they started, you know, peppering me with questions, wanting, you know, to ask me, why are you believing what you do now? And what about this and what about that? And I really didn't have any answers. So I started looking in their own books to find out some answers. And at the same time, of course, I had to look into the Bible and find out what the Bible had to say on these issues. The more I started looking into it, the more concerned I became for my LDS friends, more in the spiritual aspect of it and things of eternity. And it was out of a genuine compassion for them as people and wanting what I feel is the best for them that I started studying this all the more. Now, it's easy to say, well, you know, you're bashing or tearing down. If bashing or tearing down is quoting people like Brigham Young or Joseph Smith or John Taylor, I plead guilty. I'll plead guilty to that if that's what you want to call tearing down. But I don't understand why Latter-day Saints seem to be so upset that I'm quoting their leaders, because I would think you would want the whole world to know what your leaders taught, unless perhaps you might be embarrassed by what they said. And if that's the case, and I'd love to talk to you about this some more, but it certainly isn't born out of any animosity towards the LDS people at all. In fact, if Mormon missionaries are not motivated by a genuine concern for the people that they are talking to, then why are they out there?
Okay, let me ask you this.
Okay.
What church do you belong to when you became a born-again Christian? What church did you belong to?
I started attending a small little independent church. The pastor happens to be my father-in-law now. But you have to understand that, Louise, you have to understand that our view of what a church is are going to be entirely different. You look at a church as being an organization. The church, according to the New Testament, however, has nothing to do with an organization. It has everything to do with people. The called out ones, the ecclesia, are people. It is not an organization, never was. That's something that the Mormon church believes, but it's certainly not something that's a New Testament concept.
Well,
so
Wait a minute.
Go ahead.
You're going on the assumption that I'm a Mormon, right?
Well, you're using all the Mormon buzzwords, so that's why I'm assuming.
Oh, am I?
Oh, yes, you are.
You know what? I was raised a Baptist.
Okay.
And yet you're sitting there and you're saying, what you're saying in essence is that Mormons do not believe in Christ. And
tell me, Louise,
not Christians, and they are.
Louise, can you tell me what the Mormon Jesus is like?
What do you mean, what's he like? He's the same one that I worshipped when I was a Baptist.
Well, that's not what Bruce McConkie said. Bruce McConkie said that you, if you're a Baptist, are actually worshipping a mythical Christ.
No, I'm not. Anybody who reads the Bible and the Book of Mormon will know.
Well, wait, let's go back. Bruce McConkie was a Mormon apostle.
I know what he was.
You do? Interesting. And you're Baptist. How do you know that?
Oh, I'm not a Baptist anymore.
Oh, so now you're Mormon.
Yes, but so I just spent 3 weeks going to church at the Church of God.
Uh-huh.
So,
Louise, can I ask you something?
It's totally different, too. They're different from the Lutheran. They're different. And I've been to all of the churches because I was raised years ago when my mother didn't drive. My father was gone a lot. I went to a lot of different churches, whichever one was closest to home. Mm-hmm. But I was baptized into the Baptist church.
Okay.
But yes, I've been baptized into the Mormon church. And
okay.
Yes, I do. I didn't change God just because I changed churches.
Well, that's good. So then you don't believe in a God who was once a man, who has a body of flesh and bones, who became God at a particular point in time then. That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
No, I do believe in that. And if you
Wait a minute.
You go back and read your Bible. Jesus Christ walked upon the earth. And he
correct.
Was a man.
I'm talking about God the Father. God the Father, the one you call Elohim. You believe that he was once a man, correct?
I believe that he's got a body of flesh and bones.
Do you believe
like
he was once a man?
Else.
As man is, God once was. As God is, man may be. Do you believe that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so that's not the God of the Bible.
It tells you in the Bible that, and you know, a lot of people say, okay, your idea of the Godhead is totally different from anybody else's. That's
yes,
not
it is.
True.
Well,
it's
your leaders have said that, Louise.
I was born, like I said, I went to the Baptist
okay.
church for many, many years.
Uh-huh.
And I believed then that there were three personages. Well, two personages and a spirit. And it's the same thing I believe now.
So you believe...
And if you can read and are not illiterate,
okay.
you should be able to find that in the Bible.
So you believe in three gods in the Godhead then, Louise?
No, I believe in God, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost.
You don't believe Jesus is God?
No, I don't believe he's
you
God.
Don't. Well,
I
then you're not a Christian, Louise.
He's God's son.
Louise, then you're not a Christian, and you weren't a Christian as a Baptist then, because that is a fundamental teaching of the Christian faith, that Jesus is God manifest in the flesh. The Book of Mormon even teaches that, Louise. I think it's in 3 Nephi. Jesus is God.
He is a God, but
no,
he is God
manifest in the flesh. You cannot say he's a God, because that would mean you have
All you're doing is trying to tear down someone else's religion. And you're doing that to earn money. That's what you're doing.
Okay.
You're tearing down.
There's no money in this, I'll
okay,
tell
Louise.
You, Louise.
Okay, Louise. All righty.
We have
you
another
have
call,
night.
Louise. Thanks for calling. Hello, Ray?
Yes.
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, hello.
Yes, Ray, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm on here.
Yes,
okay,
you are.
So you're
uh-huh. Yeah, we're getting short on time,
sorry.
So can you
There's
be quick?
There's a little bit of a delay here on my end. Well, first, I just wanted to say that to Mr. McKeever, I've actually read some stuff of yours, and I'm actually really impressed by you, and I just wanted to let you know that I have a lot of respect for you, because I appreciate what you're saying and what you're doing.
Thank you.
You're just basically laying the facts out there for the people that are having a hard time coming to grips with the very fact that in order for us to be saved, in order for us to go to heaven, we have to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's what the Mormons just don't get. You know, they call themselves Christians. They want to go under the banner of Christianity, but if you look at their past, you know, their leaders wanted nothing to do with Christianity. And then all they do is, like the lady before me, all she said is you're just tearing down somebody else's religion. How can you be tearing something down if you're stating facts? And
right.
The thing is, they always come, like the hot button words that you said. I mean, they're always coming out with, it's like, well, you just have the spirit of contention in you. You know, you just don't believe in the true church, or that's just your personal opinion. That's something that's been told to me. I'm from California. I've been out here for 4 years, and I'm going on a rant. I'm sorry. I should stop and give you an opportunity to say something.
Yeah, we're getting low on time, too, and Craig, so... Can he make a remark off the air for this?
Well, no, I just wanted to say I appreciate what you're doing. I think you're doing a great job. God bless you. Mr. McKeever, God bless you.
Thank you.
And
man,
I look forward to seeing you on the show again sometime. But just one thing that struck me, and I'm not sure if it was a message from God or what, but their whole belief system is based on the fact that Joseph Smith says so.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. You know, if I might comment, how much time do we have?
Because we just have just to...
It's unfortunate because many times there are a lot of cliches, little one-liners that a lot of Latter-day Saints use to try and stifle conversations. And I think as Christians, we have to be aware of that. To say that we're tearing down or, you know, things like that, it's just ridiculous. And then you have the ad hominem, well, you know, they're all in it for the money, or the one I love, is, you know, pastors that disagree with Mormonism are scared because their congregations are going to the Mormon church.
Mm.
I mean, I hear these things.
Yeah.
I could put a whole page together of lines like this. And unfortunately, Christians are actually intimidated by lines like that. And they shouldn't
they
be.
Are. They shouldn't
I think
be.
We need to challenge our Latter-day Saint friends.
Exactly. You know? I mean, you know, we go, several people in my church say, we have to go to them with love and show them love. And I mean, you have to have love in your heart, but at the same time, you can still challenge what they're saying. That's not hate. That's not being hateful. That's just challenging them on basic, fundamental Christian doctrine that Mormonism is just nothing at all like.
I think we have to take a stand for the truth.
Like I said, once again, God bless the both of you.
Thank
you. I look forward to watching your show many, many times, and you're doing a great job, Mr. McKeever. I love you, sir, and appreciate you. God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. Okay, we are getting very short on time here. Craig has an off-the-air question. I don't fully understand, but he's newly from Michigan. He says, celestial families, what age? I'm not understanding the sentence. How far does the family extend in the hereafter? Forever, for eternity. Their families are supposed to be forever and ever. And do they believe that they all get to be gods of their own planet? We only have can you do it in 10 seconds?
They're hoping to. In order to become a god, you have to practice celestial law, which is basically keeping all the commandments. According to D&C 25:15, unless you keep all the commandments where God is, you cannot go. This becomes a real difficulty. I've never met a Mormon yet in my 30 years of ministry who is actually doing what the Mormon Church expects them to do in order to achieve it.
It's impossible.
If any Mormon becomes a god, it means that God lied in the Doctrine and Covenants in the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really ready to defend that.
Okay, and we're getting close to the end now. We want to thank you for being here, Bill. And when your new book comes out, I want you back on the show so we can talk about some of those quotes.
Great.
Very quickly, next week our guest is going to be Evan Hansen. He is a counselor who counsels people after they have come out of polygamy, and he'll talk about some of their trauma that they have to go through. I'd like to remind you all that there's a gift. It's a gift of God, which is Jesus Christ and his death on the cross for your sins. And eternal life is a gift. It is not of works, so no one can boast. We want to invite your feedback. Please email us. Let us know what you want to do as far as the support group goes. Thank you for joining us. You have a standing invitation to be here. Good night.
This has been the audio podcast edition of Polygamy, What Love Is This? This program is a production of A Shield and Refuge Ministry and Main Street Church of Brigham City. You can view current and past video episodes as well as download audio episodes of this program at whatloveisthis.tv. If you or someone you know is in need of assistance in leaving a polygamous situation, please contact us. We are here to help. All of our contact information can be found at shieldandrefuge.org. Or call us at 877-425-9993. If you have any questions or comments about this or any of our other programs, we'd love to hear from you. Write us at email@whatloveisthis.tv. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again.